I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
On several occasions, you've mentioned the importance of having your team of trusted consultants in place, and I gather that's both to fill in any gaps in your knowledge and also to help multiply your time, especially if commercial property investing is not your main activity. But what if it is? Would you then need a different sort of structure around you?
When commercial property investing starts to become your main activity, the consultants you have, you still need the core ones on property advice, legal input, finance, building construction. But you're right, the structure does change. The way you arrange, organise things from your own perspective, and the way you use your consultants is in a different manner. The important thing is that you've got to be focusing on doing deals, identifying deals, working out whether deals worthwhile pursuing. Do they make it onto the shortlist? If they do, then to analyse them. And you do it with the support of your consultants. But once you do it as a full-time activity, you then need to become creative as far as delegation is concerned, because you're going to find yourself becoming overwhelmed, and that's the last thing you want to do. You know, as I say to people that decide they want to manage the properties themselves, you know, it just becomes so time-consuming. Property management is a time-consuming exercise, and therefore you ought to leave it to people that do it day in, day out, because the highest and best use of your time is bringing deals to the table, identifying, as I said, networking to make sure you hear about them, ideally first, but certainly early in the marketing program, preferably before they even get to the market. So the whole emphasis and the structure around you needs to change, not only for you to survive, but for you to be successful.
So what you're saying is that some of the consultants will be the same, but there will also be a few extras involved as well. And I'm sensing that they would probably be divided into several groups if you are now operating at a full-time commercial property investor.
Yeah, I suppose they would be separated into several groups, and maybe we start with, well, the first thing I would do is to make sure you have assistants, and in the past that would be getting an assistant, and I think for you had an assistant, but if you haven't done it before, you understand how beneficial it is, and you wonder why you didn't do it earlier. But most people nowadays can't necessarily justify the cost of an assistant, and also wonder whether they will have him or her fully employed. Now, you can do it part-time, but the problem with that is whenever you want them, that's not the time that they're working. So what I do, and I don't actually employ anyone full-time, but I have a lot of assistants, and they are effectively virtual assistants. And I've got someone in the Philippines, another one in Croatia, someone in Poland who actually happens to be Australian, one in UK, and I've just recently appointed another one in Jamaica. Now, they undertake specific tasks as and when I require them to be done. And what I tend to do with the way I run my activities and my business is that I distill things down into a process or a system. Now, once you get something down to a process, it means that it is doable, it's delegatable. Someone else can do it. And that's the problem, that most people never take the time to sit down and understand what it is that they do and document it. And once you can do that, you can farm that particular aspect out to someone. And it doesn't have to be the same person every time. And as I said, I've just found people with these skills that I need spread all around the world. And one of the real advantages is, with most of them being in the other parts of the world, is that I can give them instructions overnight, and invariably I'll get them back the next day. So the time that is not productive for me is the time that they're working away, beavering away, doing the things that I want them to do, and it comes back. Now, look, it's not always perfect. I accept that, and you might have to tweak things, but the grunt work's all done, and it means that you can focus your not only your time but your mental energy on the things that are going to earn you money, and identifying deals is what's going to earn you money.
Now, you've explained the importance of your in-house group. What about some of the other consultants?
Okay, well, the first group is what we'll call your deals team. And principally in there is the real estate agents that have the properties. And as I said, what I tend to do is to identify the junior agents within the major firms. And initially, or a lot of people doing what I do tend to only talk to the principals of the major firms because they're of that ilk. They've grown up with them or done in their business life, and they have a rapport network with them. Now, the problem with that is that they don't always see the deals first. So by going to the junior members of the firm, they're the ones at the coalface. They're the ones doing the lease deals because, particularly if you want to get good depreciation, you want a new property, it's better to get a property that's either just or recently been built. So therefore, brand new, good depreciation, it attracts a good tenant. And so as soon as the deal's done, I get notified, and no reason why, if you're doing it full-time, you can't set up a similar relationship. And I'm told of the deal even before the lease is signed. Now, that's a real advantage because, you see, until the lease is signed, that agency can't go to the marketplace and offer the property for sale. However, with an offer to lease and a deposit paid, it's effectively a binding contract. You just need to have the formality of executing the lease. So if you get to hear about it, you've probably got a 2 to 3, maybe 4 week lead time on the rest of the market. And there's no reason why you can't do a deal subject to the tenant executing the lease in the form that you've been provided with. Now, the other advantage is, and this is sort of enlightened self-interest, that junior agent doesn't have a lot of clientele. Most of the business that they will be handling will be brought in either by the company or someone senior in the company, and then handed over to the junior ones to find tenants and to sell. However, if once it goes start, it's ready to sell, then generally a manager or a director will get involved and be listed, because the client wants to know that they are there to help with the inquiry level. Probably don't do a lot, but they're there. As soon as that happens, then a significant part of the commission is creamed off, and the junior agent doesn't get the full benefit, even though they might be doing most of the work. So by having leased the property, and then in my case with my clients, they come to me, and within a week of leasing the property, they come back with an offer. And within 10 days, they finalise the deal. So that developer looks at that junior agent and says, well, this person, he or she, is really switched on. Not only have they found me a tenant, but But they've actually, within a very short period of time, found me a buyer and saved me all the marketing costs of going to auction. So in their mind, they've been bumped up. And my attitude is, if I can make the agent look good in front of their client and also their employer, well, somewhere along the line, we've all got to make some money. So this is how you build your network, your team, so that you get deals brought to you very early on. And then part of your deal team is having a good lawyer who knows how to make sure the deal sticks. I mean, very early on in my time, I found lawyers did more damage than good until I found one that I could work with. And it's a very simple process. I say to a lawyer, review the contract. If there are any issues, pick up the phone and ring the other lawyer rather than write a letter. Because the problem is, you write a 5 or 6 page letter, they will invariably misinterpret some of it and write back another 5 or 6 page letter, and all of a sudden 2-3 weeks are going to pass, and that's not good for a deal. That will can cause a deal to fall apart. So what I say to people is, or to the lawyers, is sort it out by phone, write a short 1-1.5 page confirming letter of what's agreed, and then get the document executed as soon as is humanly possible.
Obviously, the deal makers play a key role. Yet, I suspect setting up your finance would be equally as important.
Right. Well, now you've done the deal, your next part of your team are what we call the money men. So this is where your finance broker and the valuer come in. Now, the valuer will have already given you advice before you finalise the deal as to what figure, or the figure up to which he or she would be prepared to support. So when you get with your mortgage broker, then you're looking at organising the finance itself. And the sort of consultants that I put together, generally you can get an indicative proposal within 24, 48 hours. And, you know, that's the sort of speed that you need. And then the procedural stuff takes place of providing the actual formal submission to the financier. But the finance broker can help you put together that proposal. And, you know, quite often they'll give you advice going through which will keep you from making bad deals. And it may be that they can help you put together a creative finance package. I mean, sometimes they might take you to a non-bank lender that actually offers you a better deal and requires less security. And also what they'll do is to help you with the preparation and presentation of your proposal, but also can interpret very quickly the documentation that's provided by the financier. Now, yes, it has legal implications, but it also has practical implications. And, I mean, there are most contracts and leases that I can happily read and give my clients a commercial interpretation. There may be some clauses which are highly technical, which really do need legal advice, as there would be with a finance clause. But more often than not, they are standard documents, and you simply need someone that does this day in, day out to simply walk you through and explain the implications of what's involved. But, you know, a finance broker is invaluable because, I mean, their fee, while it comes out of the deal, it doesn't actually come out of your pocket. Even though effectively they're giving you advice, their fee comes back from the lender. So as I said, it's not an additional fee on top. It's part and parcel of the transaction that takes place. And the valuer swings into action once you bought the property too, because you're the one instructing the valuer so that you get a valuation that provides you with no surprises because they've already told you the figure they're prepared to support. If you've managed to secure the property for less than that, then they'll value it up at the figure you paid. And then once the finance broker has told you that the commercial terms are fine and the documentation's fine, it's only then that you assign across the valuation to the lender themselves.
Once the money men have done their job, what happens next?
Well, once you've got control of the property, even though you haven't settled, the next stage is the building team that are involved. And that involves the due diligence, where the study is done to confirm the structural integrity of the building, the services, all the various other aspects. And again, the lawyer comes in there to make sure the legal side's fine as far as the contract's concerned. So you then, the contract goes unconditional and you move through to settlement. Now, that's when your property manager swings into action. And as I said, the secret is to be able to delegate, because you don't want to be consumed with these sort of issues. Yes, the rent collection is important, but it's the relationship you have with the tenant that's equally important. And so in choosing a property manager, you need to make sure that they would treat the property and the funds involved as though they were their own. So they have the same thought process as you do as an investor. So the property manager enables you to delegate a lot of those things, such as rent collection, make sure outgoings are paid, looking after the maintenance, making sure it complies with statutory regulations, all those sort of things that go towards not only preserving your property and the value of your property, but also subtly adding value through always making sure your property is in top condition, meeting the reasonable demands of a tenant if they arise throughout the period of the lease, and making sure that your property is in a condition that if you did have to sell it at any time in a hurry, that there wasn't a mad rush and flurry of activity needed to get it in a condition that it could be put onto the market straight away.
Clearly, your management team is where you preserve and grow the property's value. So what happens when the time comes for you to sell?
When the time comes to sell, that's when you get to take the profit that's rightfully yours. And if you've done all the things that we've just discussed here, you will be in a position to do exactly that. And the last thing you want to do is leave money on the table. And that's why you need to gauge a competent selling agent to maximise the price that you get from the property. You will have heard me discuss before the stealth marketing approach that I've used successfully over the last 10 or 12 years with clients that I bought property for. But what that does is take advantage of the very latest web marketing techniques. And that's a whole nother discussion, and we really don't have time to go into it now. But this is so important that you need to understand and grasp and make sure that the agent you appoint lives and breathes all these techniques to make sure that you can extract the most money from the property. So I think that covers it from what we have time today, and I just hope that rounds off the discussion for you.
Having listened to you outline all the various aspects involved, I can see why most investors only choose to do this on a part-time basis, and then establish their close-knit consulting team, as you have often recommended. Nonetheless, I think it's been invaluable for listeners to understand what's required if they intend going full-time at some stage. Once again, Chris, thank you for your insights on this.
My pleasure, and I do hope it's been helpful.